Hello, everybody. Welcome to our event today that we're doing with Nick Mashlongo. Nicholas and I have known each other for... Nicholas, how long have we known each other?
Wow. I think since 2002, eh?
2002.
Yeah.
And we're here today to talk about his most recent novel, which is Way Back Home. The first novel we worked on together was Dog Eat Dog, which was published in 2004. And then After Tears, which was shortlisted for the Sunday Times in 2008, was published in 2007, shortlisted for Sunday Times in 2008. Nick is one of, well, the New York Times called Nick one of the most high-spirited and irreverent new voices in South African literature, or was it post-apartheid South African literature?
That's what it's saying.
Now. he's spent the last 10 years traveling the world, talking to audiences all over the world about South Africa and what's going on in South Africa today. So it's great to have him here. And he's just about to go off to Durban to take part in the Time of the Writer there. So, yeah, let's ask Nick some questions about Way Back Home and see what he has to say. Nicholas, when I first knew you, we were looking to publish new South African fiction, South African fiction that was about what was happening in South Africa 10 years after the advent of democracy. And at that time, I was very militant, and I said, I'm never going to publish a book that's about apartheid South Africa. I'm never going to do that. I'm always going to look at what's happening now. And then you came and you wrote a novel which is about apartheid South Africa. Knowing that I didn't publish novels about apartheid South Africa. Mm-hmm. Where did the idea for Way Back Home come from? I mean, why was it that you felt now you needed to look back, you know, sort of more than 20 years into the 80s and what happened with what happened in Angola particularly? What was it that made you kind of start to decide to write a novel like this now?
Okay, good afternoon. thanks for having me here. I think, you know, Way Back Home actually was already in my mind before I wrote all this story, before Dog Eat Dog and before After Tears. It was already in my mind. It was written here. The only thing that was left was just to put it into writing so that everybody could share the story with me. Why I'm saying it was written a long time ago is that the story of, because if you read it, it's about the story of, there's a story of a ghost in it, you know? That story of a ghost has been the story that was told to me, when I was about 5, you know? In Soweto, for instance, there was this lady who was... it's not very far from my street, you know. My mother used to show me that, you know, on that street there was once a lady who was killed by a car accident or something, abducted by a man, and then she came back to revenge, you know. So if you walk on that street in the night, you might get a ghost. And then that ghost, the story behind it was that as a young man who loved many people, you know, of my age, you know, when you see a very beautiful young woman in a party or something like that, and then you chat her up, you might find yourself sleeping with a ghost. So that's what she used to tell me. But the most important thing is that, you know, it's only now that I realize that within the African storytelling, when we tell stories in African tradition, we don't simply tell to entertain. We also tell stories to give you a lesson. Like, for instance, if we don't want a person to go around walking at night, you know, they will tell you a story of a ghost so that whenever it's dark, you come back home. So it will scare you to do things that are not... So the story of...
So your mother didn't want you chatting up young ladies at parties, is basically
yes.
What she's
saying. So it's always in me that, you know, even at the moment, you know, you see a lady at night and then you don't try, you are hesitant, you know. So because the story has been told to me for quite some time, you do it with a conscious mind that this might happen, you know. So there was those stories that were told, you know, when I was young. So Vera the Ghost was one of the stories that was told, that it was a lady who was, you know, went out with somebody at night and then only happened to be raped and stuff, you know, which is not a cool thing. And then she came back to revenge against any man, you know. So I realized, wow, there's a link here with what's happening in South Africa at the moment. We are living in the ghost, you know, we are almost ghosts, you know. And because the whatever Vera has done is because there was no, I linked it with the African tradition whereby in order for somebody to heal, for death to be complete, what we have to do, we have to appease our ancestors, you know. So if somebody dies here, we don't simply go and bury. If I die here, you'll have trouble here in Cape Town because you have to fly my family over here to take my spirits where I've died, you know. And then because if they don't do that, my death won't be complete. So I might come to haunt all of you, you know. So that's how it is. So that I decided, no, look, it's linked to our African tradition, and it's linked to the political, what is happening with political arena at the moment, that these people that are leading us at the moment have done some terrible things that they're afraid of telling us. Maybe that's why the country is going bananas, you know. So maybe that's because of it, you know. So that's why I had to link all these things, events, you know, that were happening, including the tradition and politics, yeah.
So if you're saying that, in a way, is Way Back Home almost a book to say, you're talking about like a story to tell people, don't do this, because this is something you shouldn't do because it's going to lead to trouble.
Yes.
So in this way, you're almost saying Way Back Home is it's a book about a guy who did bad things in the past.
Yes.
And he's now being haunted by a ghost. And it's almost a ghost story to say to the politicians that are yet to come, don't do what the politicians now have done.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think you're quite right. It's more of trying to say that, you know, in order for a country to heal, we have to admit our wrongs that we have done in the past, you know, whether it's agents of apartheid or whether these were guerrilla fighters. Both of them, there are some gross mistakes that they've done in the past. So until we admit that these are the things that we have done in the past, there's no healing. Like, for instance, the Truth and Reconciliation wanted to do just that, but it just stopped all of a sudden, you know? So that's why the healing process, it's not complete, you know? So that's what I was trying to say, that the healing is not complete, because there are people that are not coming up, you know, with things that they've done. And until we do that, we might not see the healing. Because the healing, also within the African tradition, as I've said, it's not only this little process, it's lots of processes, you know. You have to go over lots of processes. Like, for instance, we have to... I'll give an example of, say, for instance, in Way Back Home, for main character is has killed, you know? But the person that has killed, the spirit, as I said earlier on, the spirit of that person is still hanging somewhere that side. So he is the only one who knows where this person has been killed. So until he shows... You know, he comes out and say, this is the place, so that the spirit can be taken through the processes of tradition and stuff. There's no healing. So I was trying to tie both Western and African tradition together and see that sometimes, you know, we try, you know, as a nation, we think these things are very much different, you know. They are not that much different. In most cases, I see white people going to the cemetery, taking out the weed. That's what we do as well. So there are some elements which we can, you know, fuse in order to create a South African, you know, a pure South African, what is it in English? I don't know. Okay, but yeah, I think
an
you
understand. Understanding.
Okay.
So, okay, in terms of In terms of Kimati, who is the main character,
yes.
I mean, in a way, do you find it ironic? It's quite interesting you talk about Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Yes.
But do you find it almost ironic then that he, as somebody with these traditions, you know, Kimati grew up very much with these traditions, and then he went into exile and these things happened to him, and then he committed certain acts which then he was never purified for, cleansed for, or never accounted. Mm. Do you find it kind of ironic that, knowing as you do that there are people in the government who have been involved, or people around the government, the current yeah. ANC government, who were involved in crimes against humanity
yes.
in Angola, in particular, yeah. which is where Kimati kind of that's his background.
Mm-hmm.
That they coming from this background where they should atone for these sins in a very particular way or cleanse themselves in a very particular way, they haven't admitted to this.
Yes, yes, yeah. Exactly. Because everyone is trying to to depict himself or herself as this victim. Mm-hmm. You know, meanwhile, we are both victims. We are both perpetrators at the same time. So that's what I was trying to get at, because I think one of the stories that inspired this book was the fact that I had for instance Mandla Lang, I think you know him. His brother was killed by being mistaken to be, they mistook him to be a spy.
Mm.
They only found out later that he was not a spy, you know? But those people that have killed are known in the government even now, you know? So, but in most cases, when you do things, you know, the conscious, they have got conscious. There are people that have got conscious. So maybe that's where things are not working within the government, because every now and then you are haunted by this, you know, you're trying to suppress whatever is haunting you. So there were lots of people who got killed, you know, who were not necessarily political, you know, who got killed innocently. And then they are not accounted for because everybody is trying to play a victim, you know, instead of being a perpetrator. So I wanted to look also on the other side, the darker side of it, you know, that this might be what have happened in the past, and maybe it informs where we are in this present moment, because, you know, at the moment, honestly, I mean, there are lots of things that the government is doing, you know, which are very, very wrong. And then because the way, these are the things that are not happening just now. They are happening. They've got a sense of history, you know. It comes from exile. This is what it used to happen in exile. So that's what I was trying to paint, that it's not all, you know, this beauty that we see outside. There's a deeper things that people have done. Yeah.
You're saying that the government is haunted by these acts that happened in exile.
No doubt. Oh. Yeah. No doubt, yeah, it's haunted by the things that they've done in the past, because most of them, they don't want to say that these are the things that we did. They're
really
trying to repress.
Yeah.
And sometimes if you try to repress something, it becomes expensive for you, you know, and even mind-boggling, you know, sometimes your mind doesn't, you know, because you're trying to suppress this. It's lots of monies are involved in propaganda, you know, so that this kind of truth doesn't come, you know, yeah.
So I want to talk about two things, but the first thing I want to talk about is Kimati himself, because Kimati is now, after being involved in the struggle, and I think that's actually another kind of interesting point, just a little sub-point. You talk about in the book, you kind of undermine is probably too harsh, but you talk about how a lot of people who involved, who went into exile for different reasons. That these days people claim that everyone went into exile for political reasons, but in reality, in the 70s and 80s, a lot of people went into exile for other reasons, which I think is quite interesting. I mean, maybe you want to talk about that just a little bit.
Yeah, no, definitely. I know, actually, when I wrote the book, I had quite a lot of research on it. you'll be surprised that some people will go there because they were afraid of their traditional duties. Somebody, I know of a person who went into exile simply because he has impregnated somebody. And then, according to tradition, once you impregnate somebody, you have to marry them. You go out there, you have to look for a place where, you know, you can go. It's exile. I know of people who were really, really biggest Tutsis in Alexander, who have some of the people that I've interviewed, biggest Tutsis in Alexander, robbing people and robbing banks, and they were wanted by the government. They ran away to exile, you know. Whether in exile, you know, they changed because now they are in a political arena or not, I'm not sure. But I know for a fact that they went there for different reasons. You know, some of them were hardcore criminals. So not all of them were political, you know. So, you know, as a hardcore criminal, of course, you have to find a way of maneuvering. That's why you find that with the aids that were coming, like from Scandinavian countries, if I was a Tsotsi, you know, you would simply take it for yourself. You know, you become this person because you got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
Coming back to South Africa, you got nothing to lose. So what I was trying to highlight was that, yes, there were people who went there because they've got these rightful reasons to go there. But there were people who went there also because they were afraid of something. It could be traditional obligations. It could have been, you know, social obligations. It could be because they were avoiding jails and stuff like that. So that's what I was trying to highlight, that maybe we have to look into that as well, you know, in order to understand the bigger picture about exiles and insiles, you know. Yeah. Same as here in South Africa, people who were in jail, they were not in jail because they were political, political people, you know. They were in jail simply because some of them happened to be in a place where, you know, there were lots of political activities on that particular day, you know.
Yeah.
And then they happened to be swept, you know, to the jails and stuff, and they became political maybe once they were there.
Mm.
So that's what I was trying to highlight as well. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a very, it's a very interesting story, and it's strangely universal story as well. I mean, my personal experience, my great-grandfather joined up for the First World War because he couldn't get divorced. He couldn't get divorced, so he decided, you know, there was no way. The family shame would have been too much. So he decided he was 32. Everyone else who joined up was 19.
Yeah.
And he went, me. You know, I mean, I think it is an interestingly universal story as well.
Yeah.
So having said all of this, you know, we've been quite, I mean, the book itself, taking all of this into account, is quite negative about the current political situation. Do you see hope for South Africa? I mean, do you see a post Jacob Zuma space which is more positive? Or
you know, the positive thing that if I have to comment about Zuma, the most positive thing that has ever happened to South Africa is him being a president. Why am I saying this? It's because people now are aware. It made many people to be political. You know, now we know that people no longer follow the ANC because they can see a corrupt person, you know. So if it wasn't him, we wouldn't have seen this corruption, perhaps, you know. We would have thought, okay, it's the ANC. I'm voting because it's the ANC. Now people are starting. That's why you see new political parties coming up, you know. So if it wasn't for Zuma, we wouldn't have seen this. You know, Zuma made South Africa to be political, made everyone in the township where I come from to want to go and vote. Some want to vote him out, some want to vote him in, you know. So it just made, imagine if it was still Mandela and was doing all of these things, you know, and with him being an icon of the nation, nobody would have cared about politics. I said, okay, let's give him another.
Guy.
Yeah. Right now, everybody wants, that guy, let's vote him out. You know, I haven't voted, but I want him out. You know, whether he's from the ANC itself or what. And I think it made South Africa to be a very good multi-party system to work very well, you know, because now people are aware, they've got choices now. parties are breaking away from him. So the ANC's hold to power, it's being challenged, you know. And it's no longer like, what is more interesting, I mean, from where I come from in Joburg, it's no longer like I have to vote because there's a black political leader there. I want to vote for the right things, you know. And who's coming with the right things? Whether it's DA or not, I don't want this man. Or whether it's DA or not, I want this man. So it has made us to be politically aware and to be politically interested, because the new generation, you know, were much more not political, so to say. But at the moment, there are quite a number of them that are very much political because they can see corruption in their faces. Mm. So that's why I think Zuma is the best thing that has ever happened in that thing, in that way, you know.
Which is interesting. Two things I want to talk to you, because I mean, your daughter is how old's your daughter now?
Yo,
is she 19?
21.
Is she 21?
It is possible.
We got really old really quickly.
I'm 41. I'll be 41 actually. I was so naughty when I was at school.
I was so naughty.
Very, very naughty boy.
That story about the ghost really didn't work.
I go to gym every day, yeah. No, I'll be 41 in June, so yeah.
So she's 21. So how is she going to? I mean, what's her view? How is she going to vote on this? I mean, what's, because obviously that's your most obvious connection to a younger generation.
You know why I don't like my daughter that much? And at some point we didn't talk. She wants to vote for Ellen Zille for all these people, you know. she wants to vote for.
Who do you think she should vote for?
That's why I said to myself,
Lakota.
No way. You know, no way. Actually, you know, I just thought, well, maybe it's a good decision, because that's what I'm saying. The new, generation at the moment, you know, with us. I mean, I'll start with me. When I voted in 1994. I just wanted to vote for to see a black face government, you know. That's what I wanted to do. Whether they would be good or bad, I just didn't care. I was tired of white people seeing them up there, you know. So I just said, okay. With her, she doesn't see color. That's very much more interesting. What she sees is, somebody who will do the best thing for her, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it's and it's not only her, it's lots of some, like for instance, my nephew is very convinced that, by the way, my nephew is a man, you know, with us, when African point of view, we don't have it's a cousin, you know, whether it's a female or male, you know. So, yeah, my nephew, he is too much into Malema. You know,
he is
too much into Malema. He even has this red beret.
Yeah.
And then my daughter now is very much happy because Helen Zille has come with a beret as well. Eh? so it's a blue beret and a red beret in one house. You know, so I like that. You know, the other day we were watching TV news, and then he came in a little bit late when Malema's launch has been, they've talked about it already. So he wanted to change the channel. But in this channel, they've promised that Ellen Zille will be talking in Limpopo or something. And then they fought over a remote control. You know? So it's quite interesting the way the politics are nowadays, you know. Yeah, so...
So do you... Because there was a story, and this has got very political rather than very literary, but there was a and I think a lot of people don't know that you actually studied politics at university.
Yes, I did.
Which is why the political view in your novel, in your novels.
Yeah.
But do you... Because there was a report the other day that said, I think only 35% of young people now voting for the first time had registered to vote. So do you feel, I mean, obviously, you know, you're much more in touch with what's happening in Soweto.
Yes.
In Soweto, they are very politically motivated.
Very, very much so. I think most townships, because I do some journalism. I do write for different, newspapers, but not South African ones, because they don't want my views in most cases.
Yeah, we know you're trying. So, your views on Jacob Zuma shocked everybody in this room.
So it happened that they wanted me to write about these two parties, the EFF and the ANC. But on the focusing on the launch, you know, there was a launch of EFF in a township called Tembisa. Mm-hmm. It's east of Joburg. So, and the ANC, there's two stadiums there. So, on the 3 kilometers from each other, I think you might have heard about this. ANC was launching its own things. EFF was launching its own things. So, I had to cover both, so that I get a good view. So the street was red, most of the street on the other side. The other side was about 60, the most things that I've seen were buses, Mm-hmm. So what's more interesting, the guys, the guys on the ANC side, when we're driving towards they were handing nice T-shirts, these nylon ones, nice ones, free of charge. So asking us to come into into the stadium and to write about. Because I was wearing a journalist tag and stuff. Mm. So they were giving us, but everyone, they'll just call you on the street. Even, I was so surprised to see many people there. You know how poverty is in the township. You will find that many people who carry, women will carry 3 of their children, as young as, because there were no sizes of young children. Mm. So they will be wearing those big T-shirts. And you go to the other side, the T-shirts were sold. And these ones were buying, And the exciting, the most interesting thing was that the other side of the ANC was full of buses. The other was about 60, 50,000. The other one was about 10,000. Mm. But what you could see was mostly the buses, within the ANC side. Mm-hmm. So I've heard that those who were there at the EF, so they used the ANC buses, wearing ANC, T-shirts. Mm-hmm. And then once they deliver, once they get off the bus there, they go to the other side.
They went to the other one.
So it was quite interesting to learn that how these things are working at the moment. That's what I'm saying. The political atmosphere is very much working at the moment. Mm-hmm. And the following day, I had to drive to the DA's launch in Limpopo. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, there were lots of people there. So I don't think here there will be lots of people. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised to find that it was a full house as well.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was just a full house, and you find that. That's why I'm saying, Zuma is the best thing that has ever happened. It could have happened like that if ever he wasn't there, All of us would be saying, ANC, let's give them a little bit of 5 more years, 6 more years. But now I like the diversity. Politics is no longer seen in terms of color. Mm. It's seen in terms of righteousness, what people are coming with, So it's quite interesting. I forgot your question. What was
No, I forgot it too. Okay. Can I ask you, can I ask you another political question, which is to write this book, to write Way Back Home, you spend a lot of time drinking a lot of whiskey with a lot of ANC people. It was very hard work. and we all appreciate how hard you worked to get to the point where you could finish the novel.
And the greatest thing is that, I wrote a little bit of bad stuff about them, but I'm happy that they don't read. So nobody will, find out what I've written.
And you've lost all of that whiskey weight now, because you got really big, and now you're going to gym, and now you're fine.
Yeah.
But do you think, having spent all that time talking to a lot of the people inside the ANC, and a lot of people who are very highly connected, people like Mandla Langa, who, he's incredibly well connected. The Langa family is I mean, they are
untouchable,
basically. I mean, they have such great connections. Do you think that the what is going on now around Zuma and everything which is happening within the ANC, do you think it will actually split the party? I mean, do you think there will be a split?
What are you talking about? The party's already split. It's already split. I think, okay, this is my political opinion, and I'm not supposed to say anything about politics, you know, because I'm a literature person. But it's my own opinion. I really think that the ANC is still going to rule, but not in the majority that they used to enjoy, you know, because within the party, at the moment, you know, it's split, you know. For instance, I doubt it if ever ANC will command a majority in Gauteng because of the ETOLs, who is benefiting. It's a good thing. In Gauteng, we got a very good transport system, but who's benefiting out of those things, you know? And then we are benefiting in terms of travel, but the real people in the ANC are the ones who are, you know, who are owning those companies, you know, you know. But I really feel that it has opened a very good, I would feel guilty not to vote for the ANC if Mandela was still there. You know, right now, I'll feel very much happy. I'll sleep at night if I don't vote for them, you know, because even within itself, there are people that are not going to vote that I know. Look at the list that they've just released not so long. It's a list of thieves, you know. We got Dina Pule is there. We got John Block is there. We got, who else? I mean, quite a number of people are there who are just, who have got, you know, dark shades following them, you know. Shadows, whatever in English you call them. But that's what I think. And people are aware of those kind of things. They are asking questions about around those things, you know. And then you can see that there's complete purging, you know, that is going on. Like, for instance, most popular ANC person that we know that is very good in mobilizing people around Joburg, it's Paul Mashatile. It's not even in the list. Because it's not in good relations with the president, you know? And then that's why you find that people now are starting to see that, you know, if you vote for this, you're going for the thieves to go back and eat again. But also people are still asking themselves, if you vote for a person who has already eaten, maybe he's tired of eating. Maybe when you vote him again, he won't eat anymore because there's no more, nothing else to eat. So you vote for a new person, he will start eating. From the start, so it's a dilemma, you know. But honestly speaking, I don't think it will command such kind of support as it used to. Whether it's going to win or not, I'm sure that it might win, but not in that because right now what is happening is just disaster. That's why they even released the list late, you know.
Yeah,
so it's the list that you see there is a list of thieves, you know, nothing else.
Two things. I think the first thing, just Paul Mashatile is part of a group of people who are wonderfully known as the Alex Mafia.
Yes.
Which is, they're all from Alexandria. They've made very good political careers for themselves. I didn't know the Alex Mafia were out of favor, which is quite interesting. The second thing, I think you talked about Mandela. I think that's quite interesting. Do you think a lot of people feel that way? A lot of people feel like now that Mandela is gone, almost they can sleep at night if they don't vote for the ANC. Do you feel that?
There's a saying among the academics and also people of my age in Joburg who are saying, they're using Nietzsche, you know, God is dead, man is free. Because they were not free when Mandela... there was freedom, I understand, but the most important thing is that people were saying, look, there's nothing that we can do to oppose Mandela. First of all, many people were questioning the fact that he kept quiet when Zuma was chowing all those monies, you know. If he had said, no, don't chow too much, maybe he would have listened, you know. So he never did that.
Mm.
But yet, he still commanded the highest power. And even when Zuma chowed the money and said, okay, well, now we want a vote, we want people from Khayelitsha to vote, they fly him over. He didn't say no, did he? Just came to Khayelitsha on the helicopter, sick as he was. Whether he was forced to do that or not, we don't know.
Yeah.
But because it was him, people were saying, okay, it's fine. So it means that you are sided in somehow, some way.
Mm.
There's this side of him which was siding with what was happening. I mean, the silence, the omission, you know, of not talking about it. But the mere fact that now that he's gone, people feel freer
to make
their own choices.
Yeah.
Because we feel like the choices were made for us. You know, you couldn't oppose Mandela in public. I wouldn't be saying this, you know.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Really interesting. Talking about Mandela as well, I just want to talk quickly before I ask for questions. The new novel that you're currently writing, having said that, that you now, with Mandela's passing, you now feel freer to make your own choices.
Yes.
The new novel that you're writing is about Mandela.
Yeah.
No. Are you?
I'm scared. I must not say it.
Are you prepared to talk a little bit about?
No, okay. The novel that I'm writing, it's a, you know, I'm us literary people, you know, we overstep boundaries, you know. So it's about there's this myth around, you know, when you sit around with township people, they always talk things. They've got lots of things to say. So they'll say, what if Mandela that we saw was just a clone? They killed him long time ago, so they got a clone. I mean, by then many people in the township believe that, you know, a white person is capable of anything, you know. So they can clone and then make a person who looks like Mandela, teaches him closer, so that whatever they say is science. No land, you know, and stuff like that. So I'm writing such kind of, but it's a hearsay from the township. So I listen quite a lot of what people are saying, that maybe Mandela was a clone. Maybe that's why he divorced Winnie. Maybe she said, oh, no, this is not my husband. You know, such kind of things, you know. And then you're right, yeah. So,
well, it's a very interesting idea because, I mean, for so long, nobody knew. You know, people hadn't seen his face, so they didn't know necessarily what he looked like.
Yeah,
and the Mandela who came out of prison was not the freedom-fighting Mandela who went into prison.
Yeah, even Sisulu and whoever was imprisoned with him, they say he left in 82. Yeah? To somewhere else, huh? What if it's... as I'm saying, white people are capable of anything according to us.
Okay. We're almost at the end. Can I ask if there are any questions? Does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask Nicholas?
I do. Okay, Nick, you said that I'd like to get back to the ghost.
Yes.
Because I'm interested in the moment at the way in which the supernatural functions in South African literature and contemporary South African literature. So I just want to get this clear. You start with the story of the ghost. You started by saying that the story of the ghost was just a story, like a didactic little story to warn kids off picking up and sleeping with strange women.
Yeah.
Okay. But then you also say that part of African culture and African traditions has to do with the ritualistic cleansing and claiming of the dead.
Yes.
The correct burial and cleansing. So on the one hand, you're saying that the story is just a story, but on the other hand, you're also linking it to something that's a reality in African culture. Which has to do with sort of putting the dead to rest. In other words, like leaving the ghosts, putting the ghosts in their place.
Yes.
So I just want to, this is going to sound really blunt, but when you say that we kind of need to do a cleansing for the secrets and the ghosts that have not been put to rest by the MCU because they never gave account at the TRC about what happened in the MK camps, are you envisioning sort of something literal, like a cleansing ceremony, or do you mean something more juridical, like that they must get give account of themselves in front of the law? Or do you think it should be something more like a ritual cleansing that needs to be done? Like, how do you see the possibilities for that?
It's quite a good question, and I never thought somebody would ask me in that way, because it's difficult to answer it. And I think whichever way that will help us to know that, what I was trying to say is that, you know, there's too much denial. And then I don't mind whichever way this cleansing comes, you know, comes. But this denial is the one which is a problem, you know, because the moment in African tradition, the moment you say, okay, this is what has happened, you have to do the things properly. Yeah, you have to do the, yeah, properly, and those ancestors and stuff. But within the ANC, not only the ANC, actually, I'm just saying, I just use the ANC because now it's the ruling party, is the one, when we hear about tender and corruptions and stuff, it's them, you know? Because, as I say, yeah. But the thing is, like, what I'm thinking about, it's the holistic kind of a process. You know, what happened in the TRC, just to make an example, you remember that somebody will say, I'm the one who killed so-and-so. I've done this to, I've burned their bodies, or I've, the families, what they wanted to hear, if you followed it quite, yeah, what they wanted to is, where did you bury him? Yeah. So that we go and take the spirit. So what did they do? They went there spiritually themselves. Psychologically, it helped. Mm-hmm. You know, it helped them to lay to rest this matter which has been with them for quite some time. So I'm saying there are different ways of cleansing in South Africa, including the one that you are talking about, yeah. The physical thing.
A juridical, because it seems to me like a juridical investigation is quite a Western way of dealing with it.
Yes.
But the family cleansing thing is more private.
Yes,
So I guess to publicly deal publicly with it in a juridical way so that the families might privately
Yes, exactly. Exactly what has happened to, for instance, you might have seen the Credit for how the families were. Yeah, even though the person who killed them said, "I've banned them." They went to the place where psychologically they healed. Psychologically they healed. Whether in Western tradition, you might not see it as healing, you know, but within African point of view, it's healing in itself, because we have been exactly where the spirits are.
Yeah.
So, because in African tradition, we don't die.
Yeah.
You know, I live 100. If I die, if somebody does anything to me, when I'm an ancestor, I'm going to. I'm not going to do them any favors as well. You know, that's an African tradition. You know.
So it's more would you say it's more of a private?
Yes, it starts with the public.
Yeah.
And then ends up private.
Okay.
Just like the book, it starts with a public thing and then ends up with a private thing.
Yeah.
And then in that way, they've healed, you know. Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah. Barbara?
I wanted to build on the last question. You might be aware of an amazing initiative that was done in London called the Methodist Bishop at the time of Bumadandala, the Methodist Church partnered with traditional healers, and they did joint cleansing ceremonies in the townships.
Yes.
So I was wondering, A, whether you're aware of it, B, whether something like that you might have ideas about how to improvise.
No, you're quite right. I think these things are with us. I think I like your angle as well, you know, your question. Because these things are with us. You drive, I don't know, here in Cape Town, you drive quite a lot, and then wherever, or along the road, you will see wherever there was an accident, you'll see a cross, isn't it? What does that symbolize? It symbolizes that we know that this person is... So. The mind is resting because we know exactly where it started. Imagine if you don't know where these things have started. You know, as long as you know, psychologically you become healed. You know, so Like, for instance, when I was growing up in Soweto, it was so easy. In the morning, you'll find that we wake up in the morning, and then there's a person who is dead, and then there's newspapers here. Sometimes you play soccer, you know, and then the ball rolls into the towards the body. It was something, but the families will still come and cleanse that. Because if they don't come and cleanse that, psychological to us that we don't have to step on that. You know, we don't have to step on that until it's cleansed. So they have to take their stool. Otherwise, there will be lots of accidents happening, you know, within the family. So that's how we believe in African tradition in most cases. And it helps us quite a lot, as I'm saying, to be appeased. It appeases us, you know, and say, no, look, okay, we have laid this matter to rest now. So let's move on with our lives. So this person is finally becoming an ancestor, so he can look after us. Because if we don't do that, that person will be angry. The spirit of that person, it's just hovering everywhere else. It will cause trouble everywhere else, you know. So we wanted to bring it and meet the spirits of those ones that have died long time ago, you know, so that it has a home. A spirit has to have a home, according to us. And that's when the cleansing and the process of, in our minds, we are cleansed as well, you know, because the person has finally been reconnected with the dead. Yeah. Okay.
Was there one? We'll take one, and then there's one at the back as well.
Uh-huh. I want to ask you something, and I suppose it's a question that you often get.
Yes.
You're presumably not writing in your home language.
No, I'm not writing in my home language. No, I am, actually. I am.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, that, actually. Yeah. I think you should just say a little bit about that, because it's really interesting. Yeah.
I thought, because if you're not, do you find it a kind of a loss? There's a certain readership, presumably, that if you write in English, you lose.
Yeah.
But there's also a readership that you win.
Yes.
Was it a conscious, what kind of choice was it for you to write in English?
Okay. It was very much of a simple choice, actually. Because since I went to school, it was always English. I don't speak English well, so that's why I'm saying it's my language. It's a bastard English. That if you read my books, there's nothing closer to James' English. It's just bastardized English because I use different languages. In my book, it's possible to read all 11 South African languages in one book, you know? Because that's the language that we speak in the townships, for instance. We use different languages. We use Tsotsitaal. I thought I had written a book in English, but it came to me, what is all this? Because I always mention, so we went and we stopped at the robot. So what is a robot? That's our English, isn't it? It's our language. We have adopted it, yes. It was foreign before white people came, like James. So, but we made it our own. We made it our own, and we speak it in our own terms, in our own way. It's a new language altogether. So it's no longer an English of English people. It's an English of South Africans and of black people as well. So that's why language itself is fluid. I speak. My mother is Shangaan. My father is Zulu. So I speak Zutu. It's a combination of different languages, of Sotho and Zulu. You know, you might not understand. Somebody will speak Afrikaans, Tsotsitaal, which is in a sentence, there are 11 languages on it. You know, so if I write and I say for example, I would have used Shangaan, nobody would have, I don't know the language purely. You know, even my mother, even when I was young, my mother would say, no, but that's a Zulu word. I said, my father's Zulu. You know? So I'll mix different languages. So I don't have a specific language to say. And the language that I'm using, many people in the township, whether they're educated, they've been to universities or not, they can easily read it. You know, yeah.
Unfortunately, we have actually run out of time. I know there's one more question. You're welcome to come ask Nick at the end. Now is the end. Any question you have, I'm sorry about that. But we have to wrap up because people are clamoring to get in. Thank you all so much. Thank you.